I don't know if any of us really understand our own moral frameworks and our own will to fight, let alone the adversaries, right? So when it comes to operational planning, strategic planning, those are notoriously hard to measure.
Greetings and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war.
I'm Major Kelsey Kurtz, here alongside Majors Dan Warner and Josh Bedingfield, and we'll be your hosts today. Today's guest is the lead planner for the Joint Indo-Pacific Command, Lieutenant Colonel Nathan K. Finney. Lieutenant Colonel Finney is the creator and co-founder of the Strategy Bridge, a founder of the Military Writers Guild. He is the co-editor and author of Redefining the Modern Military, The Intersection of Profession and Ethics, and the editor and author on Strategy, a Primer. He regularly contributes to the Project on International Peace and Security, Military Strategy Magazine, the Military Writers Guild, and the Council on Foreign Relations. Lieutenant Colonel Finney is a graduate of the SAMS ASP3 program and recently earned his PhD in history from Duke University. Lieutenant Colonel Finney also holds a master's degree in history from Duke University and public administration from Harvard University and the University of Kansas. Sir, welcome to our program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be in here.
You recently graduated from the ASP3 program and stepped into the lead role for strategy and campaign planning within Indo-Pacific Command, a theater where the U.S. military is focused on competing with the People's Republic of China while growing stable connections with allies and partners in the region. You've written extensively on issues that involve strategy, building partner capacity, security sector reform, security force assistance, stability operations, and the integration of civilian and military agencies. Your academic experience gives you unique insight on several of the key challenges and problem sets your team is facing in the theater. And we'd like to talk to you today about the value of the human dimension in operational art. So all of that aside, can you briefly describe for the audience your definition or theory of operational art?
Sure. So I generally stick pretty close to the doctrinal answer. You know, I would define operational art is the planning and employment of military forces to achieve the objectives of a campaign. And so for me, it's kind of the last bit that really matters, at least in my current position as a campaign planner at U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. In that position, I've had the opportunity to see just how hard it is to translate that fairly simple sentence of operational art into a viable product for a large organization, let alone help create unity of effort to drive subsequent activities to support the achievement of a rather robust amount of strategic guidance we're getting out here in Indo-PACOM.
Yeah, so you're the, in sequence of reporting, you're the fourth guest we've asked about the definition of operational art. And what I find interesting is that while you're here in the schoolhouse, you know, one of the core questions we get that is one of the essential questions on our oral comps is, you know, what is your definition of operational art? And Dan and Kelsey can kind of jump in here if they feel differently, but it almost feels like we're encouraged to find a way to make it our own. But you're the fourth one that has leaned very heavily into the doctrinal answer. I'm curious if at some point in time or another, whether it being during your course of studies through ASP3 or when you were out at your primary military education for field grade, did you at every point in time feel like you leaned further away from the doctrinal answer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I am not a, you know, SAMS trained guy, right? So I didn't go to AMSP as a SAMS guy. And so I actually ended up kind of backing into operational art a little bit later in my career after focusing a little more heavily on strategic art. I went from being an armor officer as a senior captain, jumping up to being a strategist. And so my initial focus was very much on learning strategy development, and strategic art. And so I only kind of backed into operational art as a major going to ILE, going on to the HQDA War Plans Division, and then doing war planning at U.S. Army Pacific. So my delving into operational art was very, honestly, very practical, right? I had to figure it out in order to do planning. I had some great mentors like Francis Park and Adam Sanderson and some others, Jim Greer there at, now at SAMS, who helped me to better understand what, you know, operational art was, what operational planning was. And so backing into it, as we all do as military officers, particularly Army officers, the first place that you start trying to understand a concept, military concept, is doctrine. And so going to doctrine, understanding what the definition of operational art was and operational planning was. My definition has changed very little because it is a very practical definition and very easy to translate into actual action and actual planning. So I would say, you know, for the most part, my definition, my personal definition of operational art has not changed much. It has just changed on the margins as I've tried to figure out how to do planning, so war planning, but also now campaign planning. But, you know, there's some tweaks in there just to match desired end states and objectives to the strategic guidance that you're trying to achieve in campaigning. But generally, it still fits that definition.
Sir, how has that progressed over time with connecting strategic art and the strategic level with the operational level, especially like as you advance in your career, coming from the field, being a maneuver officer, and now in strategist, and then doing the ASP3 program?
So it is each of those concepts and each of those kind of ideas have a different place depending on what your job is, right? So, for example, working on HQDA staff, didn't do a whole lot of strategic art. You had to understand civil military relations. You had to understand the building, right? The relationship between OSD, joint staff, Army staff, between the services themselves, all the PPBE process, all the budgeting, and where you fit, what you were working on for HQDA staff. So there is to a degree, a sense of operational art in that, but it's much more, you know, I don't want to coin a new term, but it's much more institutional art than it is operational art, right? A guy named Colonel Dan Sukman, who's up on the Joint Staff Army Strategist, has written quite a bit on kind of institutional strategy. And I don't think he's written on institutional art, so I may have to steal that and take that away from him. But so there's that piece. But the whole the concept of operational art, right? Like the sequencing and the integration of things in order to achieve a defined objective still applies when you're doing institutional stuff like that at HQDA. And then when I was in USERPAC, war plans, doing kind of the lead China plan out here for the Army, that was when probably I would say I most applied operational art while still understanding some of the strategic art. I was lucky to be on General Brown, the USERPAC commander's CAG, prior to being the lead war planner. And so understanding his vision, understanding INDOPACOM's vision at that time, Admiral Harris's vision, allowed me to understand where they were aiming, where the Army fit in that process, and then therefore, you know, how I could align what the Army should be doing for the numbered plan through kind of the operational approach, operational art aspects.
Sir, you kind of highlighted understanding the commander's vision within the institution several times. We've recently kind of discussed that within the SAMS program as we went through our first military-oriented exercise. Do you have any tips and tricks that you have found successful in your career to better understanding your boss, your commander, and their vision?
It's tough. I mean, it really depends on quite a few factors, you know, and at some point I'll probably get into human dimension, but there is a human dimension aspect to any staff, to any organization, to any leader that you need to be able to understand, to be able to understand their vision. So when I was on a commander's action group or a commander's initiatives group, it's very easy to get the commander's vision because you're essentially with them very frequently. You're in the room with them. If you're, you know, depending on the CAG, you get lots and lots of time to discuss with them many issues. And so it's very easy to elicit that vision because they're pretty much just telling it to you or you're hearing it in meetings. When you are down on a staff, you know, you're a planner in the G5, J5, kind of removed from that, it's much harder to find the vision. And that's when it becomes incumbent on the officer to find ways to figure it out. And you can't necessarily trust that it's going to filter down through all of the levels. Even, you know, if you have a very robust communication chain in your organization, which, to be fair, most military organizations I've been in, they don't have robust communications mechanisms where it's not put through different lenses and therefore kind of diffuse that vision. And so what you have to do is you have to figure out the nodes, either the people or the processes or the meetings that you can go to start eliciting that vision. I'll give you an example here at Indo-Paycom. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning is operations and intel brief to the commander. If he's not there, you know, deputy commander takes it, but it happens every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so that is one way for me, as somebody that is quite removed from the commander, you know, I'm not in his office every day. You know, every other week or something, I'm briefing him, and that's about it. And it's usually on a niche topic. So I'm getting a decision on something. I'm not getting the overall vision. But being able to go to that ONI and hear what he is getting briefed, whether it's from the intel realm or the ops realm, to hear what the commander is saying and how he's reacting to something, to see how the different staff elements are briefing him and what they are briefing him, provides some context for me to be able to understand, at least at that point in time, where the commander's mind is at, what is important to him. And then I supplement that with work in my own J5 world, where I can understand the type of guidance that is coming down to Indo-PACOM from OSD and Joint Staff, and recognize where my J5, two-star Marine, and the commander are reacting to that guidance to be able to understand the vision. So it's much more of a reading of the bones than it is hearing it from the horse's mouth. But that is the majority of, you know, military officers. That is how they get the vision from the commander, particularly, you know, Kelsey, you become a 59, as you become a 59, unless you're personal staff to the commander, the way that you're going to get the vision is by intuiting it through conversations and meetings.
So we're going to bridge a little bit into the Army's new operating concept, multi-domain operations. In our current concept, the Army has recently recognized, you know, some new domains, and then within those domains, some new dimensions. Among those dimensions is a formal acknowledgement of the human dimension, something that you've written quite prolifically about. I'm going to quote FM3O's definition of the human dimension and then kind of pick your brain on what that means for people who are planning at the operational and strategic level. So the human dimension, quote from FM3O, encompasses people and interaction and the interaction between individuals and groups, how they understand information and events, make decisions, generate will, and act within an operational environment. So from your perspective, sir, and your experience, how are staffs incorporating the human dimension while planning, executing, and assessing their operations?
Yes, you're really kind of pulling me back from my current joint mindset into the Army with the human dimension. And, you know, it's great. Mr. Rich Creed, who's out there at GAD writing the doctrine, you know, he's a national treasure. He was my first S3 when I was in a battalion as an armor officer. He's a fantastic human being, smartest guy I know. So it's good to see he put this helped put this into the doctrine, and I can actually, you know, I guess at an age and of an experience that I can think back and like, well, back in my day, I remember when the human dimension concept was first being injected into the Army, right, coming out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan towards the later part of Iraq and Afghanistan. Concept developers and Army leaders were really struggling to figure out both. What those wars meant, what Army forces meant in those wars, and then recognizing that we are moving to large-scale combat operations, trying to re-prepare ourselves outside of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, what lessons needed to be learned to be pulled into that. And one of those certainly was the human dimension. And one of the most kind of staunch supporters of this idea of human dimension in particular was my old boss, General Bob Brown. And he was the CAC commander and then USUPAC commander. And he really carried the evangelical mission of human dimension everywhere he went. Like, it was a part of his core leadership philosophy. I mean, he wrote, published the human dimension white paper there at CAC, who was written by an Army strategist, John Klug, now at the War College. Great, great mentor of mine. And then he incorporated into many elements out of the U.S. Army Pacific before he retired. When it gets to human dimension and operational art and the development of campaigns, I think there are key areas of campaign planning that lend themselves to the human dimension, both in the process of the planning itself, as well as considerations regarding, you know, blue forces, green forces, and red forces. So when it comes to the process of planning, understanding the personalities and preferences of a leader, kind of like we were just talking about with the vision, the social and cultural constructs of the organizations undertaking the planning, and the dual audiences of those within the organization who will execute the campaign plan, and those outside of the organization who generally will approve the plan, whether it's approving it through the plan itself or through the provision of kind of resources and authorities required to enact the plan. So think like Congress, OSD, Joint Staff. All of these human factors will dramatically affect the selection of the objectives, the development of the operational approach, and the overall tasks and effects to be achieved. So just the humans involved in the planning process are important to understand. But then when it comes to the various actors that the plan addresses, including our blue forces, adversary red forces, and allies and partners or civilian green forces, the human dimension is even more important. What we aim to achieve is wholly dependent on what our own people are capable of, what effect we desire and can achieve regarding the adversary, and increasingly, especially under our current DoD approach of integrated deterrence, how we can link in allies and partners of very different cultures, capabilities, and political calculations into our campaign. Now, each of these actors, which can expand to a dozen or more when considering some larger campaigns across time, requires an understanding and due consideration of human dimension as we develop our plan. So human dimension is integral to pretty much everything that we do when it comes to, you know, operational planning and campaign planning.
So you are just speaking to my monograph right now. So I'm on my research, I'm exploring how we can prepare military staff to plan within the human dimension using different frameworks. And the one that I focused on is women, peace, and security. But I actually have used a bunch of your research on the human terrain team within a case study to kind of show the value of using, you know, these different cultural and social factor frameworks. You know, the Indo-Pacific headquarters is one of the joint front leaders in integrating women, peace, and security into their security cooperation efforts. Are you able to speak on that at all?
So what I can say is they're doing great work out here, and their main focus is engagement with allies and partners in the region to see where we can enhance their efforts, as well as address, you know, some of the key objectives for the commander here in the Indo-Pacific.
Well, I'll hop in just to kind of tug the line a little bit on the concept of integrating the human dimension. So, you know, as we've discussed, I'm a civil affairs officer. So, you know, the human terrain is the lens at which my branch perceives the operational environment. And I'm very excited about kind of how you framed your answer there about how there's a real responsibility within the planning staff to have at least a deep enough understanding of the human terrain to acknowledge how it should influence our assignment of objectives, purposes, tasks. You've got a very unique background, having been on a human terrain team, which was the byproduct of kind of the Army's first foray into explicitly and tacitly acknowledging that we have to levy some resources towards engaging and understanding the human terrain. But the question is that if you look at an operational environment, like PACOM, one with hundreds of unique cultures and hundreds of unique peoples and such a rich tapestry of history, what are some challenges that you find in getting to a point where that understanding is sufficient enough versus spending too much time and allowing that planning to maybe get a little off track?
Yeah, so very, very good question. So what I'll say is, the answer is generally a basic staff answer, which is more people with more skills to be able to get at those problems, right? So we divide up the Indo-PACOM AOR into different specific regions, and then we tie specific offices and personnel with unique skills to those regions. So, for example, in the J5, we have different regional policy shops that focus on a region, Oceania, for example, or Southeast Asia. And in each of those offices are generally foreign area officers, but others as well, that possess some knowledge, experience, and or language skills with core countries in that region that we need to be either allying with, partnering with, or just better understanding, you know. And then they work the kind of policy and decision-making strategic elements that are then fed into things like war plans, if appropriate, campaign planning, commanders travel, interaction with OSD joint staff, things like that. And so we are bringing in this, theoretically, bringing in the skills that we need in order to address specific allies and partners or countries in each of those regions. The weight of effort is different based on kind of the campaign and based on the issues of the day. So some of those offices are more important than others. Not important as in, you know, that office is not important, but as important as that office gets a lot of the work right now because that's where we're focused, while this office is doing what it needs to do to keep things on an even keel. One thing I will say, going back to human terrain and human dimension and Indo-Pacific, is the human terrain teams were very focused on a specific kind of tactical and operational problem, and that was understanding the civilian population in which we were working in order to figure out how we can separate insurgents and the bad actors from those populations and or improve those populations' opinion of U.S. and allied forces, right? So we are trying to improve the relationships on the ground to make a better impact in the conflict. When it comes to human dimension in Indo-Pacific, it is much more focused, and part of this is because of integrated deterrence and the relationship slash competition between the PRC and the U.S., in that it's much more a perceptions and understanding battle than it is a developing of relationships, right? So most of the developing of the relationships happens at very senior levels and happens at State Department, OSD, things of that nature. Much less, just because of the nature of the relationship right now, a military-military relationship between us and the PRC. Actually, it's non-existent at this point. And so the human dimension for us is a development of perceptions. What do the leadership in the PRC, how do they perceive the United States and its actions in the Indo-Pacific? How do the PRC perceive themselves and their capabilities based on what they are trying to achieve? How do they perceive our allies and partners that we are working with in order to prevent any kind of aggressive action in the Indo-Pacific? So it is still very much the human dimension, still very much, you know, understanding the culture, understanding the language, understanding relationships, but it is a different way of looking at those things than we were on, for example, the human terrain teams, if that makes sense. And so this, so that perceptions piece obviously is much more focused on a J2 lens, right? Obviously there's a lot of intel related in that versus more kind of social sciences, though the social sciences obviously are brought to bear as well.
Yes, sir. That's great. So speaking of, you know, social sciences, you focused a lot of your prolific writing background on the social sciences, the cultural competency and social dynamics through different phases of military history from World War I era, again, to the human terrain as a tool for counterterrorism and counterinsurgency in the Middle East. So you're really expanding that human dimension over the globe, regardless of region. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about each theater's different characteristics. The Army is focusing on large-scale combat operations within Indo-PACOM. How do you think that changes the relevancy or utility of the human dimension?
Yeah, maybe at some point I can get out to UCOM and like get stationed in Germany and, you know, just cover the entire globe. That'd be great. Yeah, so, you know, how the Army addresses the human dimension is very different, kind of depending on the context of the military operation. And that's kind of what I was getting at with the human terrain team versus kind of the perceptions of the Chinese leadership. And it is still as applicable, you know, despite these differences in contexts and conflicts, it's still very relevant and applicable in both of those situations. And we as planners and we as leaders, you know, need to think about it slightly different and apply it appropriately, right? It's similar to, if you think about, you know, understanding the human dimension and how it applies in a particular context isn't terribly different, you know, logically from how we address tactics, right? We don't do the same tactics in exactly the same way, exactly the same context, exactly the same geographic locations. We have to tailor them to the context, and we have to do the same with the human dimension. We have to be able to understand that the fight in the Indo-Pacific or the competition in the Indo-Pacific is different than what we were doing in the Middle East when we had boots on the ground. And so we have to tailor our understanding of the human dimension, and more importantly, how that human dimension plays into campaign planning and war planning based on that adversary and based on AOR.
Sir, how do you see that relationship using China, right, as the pacing threat within the Department of Defense and the Army shift specifically to large-scale combat operations? How does that impact our discussion right now on ethics, professionalism, and the interaction with the human dimension in large-scale combat operations?
Yeah, so I don't know if the underlying tenets or principles of ethics or professionalism change based on, you know, the theater of conflict, or whether we're in a counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, or large-scale combat operations. I think it dramatically shifts the points of emphasis, the tactics, the capabilities, and the considerations. And when it comes to the Indo-Pacific, I think that's particularly true of the Army, right? I mean, the things that the Army can do, the things that the Army is asked to do in the Indo-Pacific are very different than they would in, say, Europe or when we were in the Middle East. And so the threats, the anticipated types of operations, and the significant limitations the theater imposes on land forces are significant. That doesn't mean, for example, in the Indo-Pacific, the Army is not relevant. I mean, that's it is critical to the theater in peacetime right now, in competition and developing relationships and deterring adversaries from aggressive actions. And it will be extremely critical if there's a crisis or a conflict in the Indo-Pacific. Operations in the Indo-Pacific require large scale and large unit command and control across vast spaces to centralize, particularly sustainment and fires, but also decentralized delegated authority and intent for small units to be able to disperse, move, achieve tactical successes to support those larger objectives, particularly joint objectives with other services in the lead. So this tension will certainly tax the core elements of kind of the professional ethics and our professionalism, and honestly, how we develop our Army officers. And so that requires, on our part, and that's, I know SAMS is heavily into this, CGSC is into this, U.S. Army Pacific has been leading this fight into TRADOC. It requires a robust front-end development for leaders and soldiers to be able to perform at different levels in different ways, right? So if you're a platoon leader, company commander, you need to be developed in order to do mission command, mission type orders, taking intent, and being able to execute and be confident that you can execute if you get cut off from communications and things of that nature. Being able to understand how to fire and disperse or conduct an operation and disperse in order to survive. But we also need to be able to develop our leaders, particularly folks like yourselves and myself at the field grade level who are working on higher level staffs, to be able to do the opposite, right? Like my job and in combatant command J5 is not mission type orders. You know, it is to be able to centralize, understand, coordinate large organizations, large processes in order so that those lower level units can do the kind of mission command type stuff they need to do. But what is challenging is I grew up in the era of Iraq and Afghanistan very much powered down to the platoon and company level. But I can't do that my entire career. As I shift the context of what I'm doing and the objectives I'm trying to achieve, I need to be able to have different skill sets to be able to achieve those things. And sometimes I feel like the conversation on like how the Army develops its leaders is stuck on small unit leadership and not on developing the staff skills, being a part, and nobody wants to be a part of the big machine. But guess what? Sometimes when you're in the Army, you're part of the big machine. You know how it works and you know how to drive it.
Yeah, the Indo-Pacific definitely seems going to force some maybe uncomfortable jointness at the field grade and even company grade levels if a conflict ever arises in there. And it'll be interesting to see how we prep our leaders for that. You know, we talk, you know, examples when we go to NTC or JRTC, it's very Army-centric, Army-focused. Even here at CGSC and then at SAMS, you know, when we touch on larger concepts of deep battle, it's very Army-centric. But I don't know if you can do deep battle in the Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific, without the Navy and then subsequently the Air Force. So, yeah, it's definitely something we have to work on.
Completely impossible. And I would say any theater, it's impossible to do deep battle at a service level. And that goes for, you know, not just the Army, right? So the Navy can do certain things to a certain degree in the Indo-Pacific all on their own. But when it comes to any kind of actual crisis or conflict, and everybody out here recognizes, not putting any, you know, shade on any of the services out here, they, out of all the geographic AORs I've worked, this is absolutely the most joint. We have our own, you know, parochialisms and fights amongst the services here. But in general, everybody understands this is a hugely a joint fight. We all need each other to be able to achieve things. It's just a fight on the margins on who's responsible for what, not that we don't need each other.
Yeah, I'm really excited right now, in case you saw me smirking on the camera, sir, about how, you know, you're having a conversation about the inherent jointness in executing, you know, something like deep battle. And in SAMS right now, we're going through Isserson, one of the forefathers of deep battle. And it's just, I personally find it quite fascinating how there are certain theaters where you might be able to argue that a component of military force, be it Navy or Air Force, might find itself to be subservient, like, say, large-scale combat operations in the middle of Poland, where the Navy is not going to play as prominent a role, and that we might find some solace in the decreased complexity of certain operational environments. But when faced with an AOR like the Indo-PACOM, where the depth of the battlefield is inherently short as a byproduct of island chains, and the terrain of the battlefield is inherently different due to the prevalence of the maritime domain, that complexity just shoots through the roof. And definitely drives at what you guys are talking about how PME has a responsibility to build leaders capable of cognitively and then tacitly acting within that environment. You know, and I don't know if we're there yet, but I'm encouraged that we've got, you know, you yourself just kind of talking about the need for it. So there is some recognition there.
Yeah, and I'd say even, you know, any kind of battle in the middle of Poland would naturally, just because of what that would entail, what type of adversary and whatnot, would require a theater-wide view, which means you're going to need air and maritime as well, right? In the Baltics and in the Mediterranean. So ultimately, any conflict that we would be in with any kind of geostrategic competitor would require a significantly joint response. And when it comes to developing the leaders to be able to do that, you know, it's across more than PME, but at some point, you know, each of the services have to develop the tactical and technical experts within their service to be able to prosecute their capabilities and role and function. So we absolutely need platoon leaders at, you know, the bullocks doing their thing, the captains at their captain's career courses doing their thing. But once we start getting up to this field grade level, I understand why we have service ILE institutions and that we, you know, shift officers to different ones. I think at some point there's going to be much more integration at the field grade level in education to be able to understand each other. But even in that education, you'll get, all you're getting is essentially like an overview, right? It's like a undergraduate level survey course. If you have an Air Force officer in your small group, or, you know, if you go to, you know, the Marines captain's career course equivalent or ILE. So what you really need is that experience across time matched with your PME. So we need Army officers going to joint staff, to combatant commands, or even to, you know, ASCCs, where a good portion of their job is integrating with the other services in a combatant command to understand that joint environment, would be very beneficial. We just don't get that in most of our branches, particularly basic branches, for very good reasons, because we have certain gates people need to go through to make them technical and tactical experts, particularly up to the battalion command level. So the challenge is there is how do you distribute that joint knowledge and that that jointness, both in mindset as well as understanding how to fight jointly, while still meeting what we need to for our services. It's a challenge, man. If it wasn't, we'd already fixed it by now.
Within that concept of the inherent complexities, and kind of tying back in the human component, the human dimension, what one of the things that it mentions is, you know, will to fight. I would argue that it indirectly references other concepts like ethics we've already spoken about, and then the moral component of operations. I'd like to bind those aspects within the concept of risk, going back to something you said earlier about, you know, the distribution of small units across a wide terrain in a theater like Indo-PACOM. And how might you encourage leaders to account for a disparity between our ethical frameworks in relation to risk, or our frameworks on our understanding of will to fight and the moral domain, against how certain adversaries might have different frameworks that might drive their risk template a little differently?
Yeah, that is a phenomenal question. And one thing I will say is I don't know if any of us really understand our own moral frameworks and our own will to fight, let alone the adversaries, right? So when it comes to operational planning, strategic planning, those are notoriously hard to measure, right? Let alone understand the impacting factors and effect when things kind of tip over from the planning into the execution. You can really just look at the current conflict in Ukraine as an example. The Russian will to fight was dramatically overestimated, certainly in Russia, right, in Moscow, but even in our own media sphere and the commentary we were getting in the run-up to the invasion. And the Ukrainians' will to fight was dramatically underestimated. Thought they were going to be turned over in a couple of days. So in the end, I think these components, particularly the will to fight, when we're thinking about kind of planning and how the conduct of operations, we need to incorporate those, particularly the will to fight, but also the moral component and ethics into our assumptions is important. And those assumptions need to have some definitive data to back up their validity. And with triggers for being reconsidered as the plan moves into execution, as well as, and this gets it, I think the difference between kind of moral frameworks and the will to fight as we actually come into contact with the adversary is coming up with risk mitigation measures should they fail, right? So if we have a concept of the enemy's will to fight and their moral frameworks, we have a concept of our own, once they clash, you know, chances are we are wrong on one or both of those fronts. So we need some sort of risk mitigation measures put into place in order to reassess that assumption and what that means for the overall fight. That applies to us, you know, as we apply it to our forces, to adversary forces, but also, and this is at a political level and an operational and probably a tactical level as well, is we need to consider our allies and partners as well. Because a lot of what we are doing, and I could say definitively in Indo-Pacific, is we're very, very focused on allies and partners in our competition, our peacetime relationships with them, as well as how we can integrate them into deterrence operations and possible conflict. So we need to not only understand our own kind of moral frameworks and our own will to fight as or the adversaries, but also any allies and partners that we anticipate or that we are working to bring into the planning and the fight as well.
What advice would you give to leaders who want to maximize their professional development through a self-study of operational art, or maybe the ASP3 program, or looking at switching into functional area 59 as one of the many options to pursue kind of greater development of campaign and war planning?
Yeah, so I'd say that number one for kind of self-study or just kind of developing as you go, the key element to kind of push into is your networks, right? Particularly mentors and kind of like-minded peers who you can gather ideas from, can have discussions with, that you can get resources from in order to pursue whatever avenues of self-study and development you want to do. You know, you guys mentioned some of the organizations that I've been blessed to be a part of over my career, including Strategy Bridge, Military Writers Guild, Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. All of those were created with that, the entire premise that we just needed to connect in smart folks with lots of energy that wanted to do interesting things together, and magic would happen. And for the most part, yeah, that absolutely has been the case. Those organizations still exist. I still tap into them all of the time. That's where I get a lot of my ideas. That's one of the reasons I met Jim Greer there at Sam's, was through a lot of those organizations, and he's been a lifetime mentor of mine and will continue to be. So mentors, find the right people, mentors, whether they're older than you, more experienced than you, or your peers, or, and I found this as I'm getting a little more senior in my career, mentors can be junior to you. They can have knowledge sets, skill sets, interests that you don't have yet that you're trying to delve into. And so don't sleep on subordinates or those junior to you when it comes to kind of mentorship relationships. Secondly, don't stick to just like one line of education or one line of knowledge, such as, just focusing on leadership or just focusing on operational art or just focusing on strategy. Delve into as many and varied lines of knowledge as you can to keep yourself fresh. So move one thing to the next to keep yourself fresh, to meet new groups of people, build new networks, as well as just keep your mind kind of moving. When it comes to like FA59, ASP3, I am always happy to talk to folks about either of those items. FA59 has been very good to me. I was interested in moving from the armor realm. I was looking at trying to just get a different view of the Army and a different view of kind of national security. I was interested in politics. I was interested in strategy and strategists, particularly their focus on education and the ability to work at higher levels was very interesting to me. And so that's why I ultimately applied. And they have given back to me in spades, right? So I've gotten master's degrees, a PhD. I've gotten to work at, very high levels, up to 4-star generals, sat in the back of VTCs and National Security Council meetings, interacted with Office of Secretary of Defense, all that kind of stuff. All the things that when you're a tactical level leader just seem ultimately impossible. And if that is something you are interested in and having impacts at kind of the policy and strategy level, FA59 is absolutely for you. We also do hardcore planning. So we get a lot of SAMS folks that transition over because they're really interested in kind of war planning from the ASCC, the combatant command, to the joint staff level. And so FA59 is very, very good for that as well. Always happy to talk about what life as a 59 is like. Always happy to talk about ways to best position yourself to compete through VTIP to get into 59. People just need to reach out. Easily accessible by many online means. Just reach out. As far as ASP3, best 3 years in the Army. I essentially got selected and they sent me off to whatever school I wanted to go to and could get into. And they, with admin things aside, left me alone for 3 years to crank out a PhD. It was absolutely phenomenal to go to a school like Duke, particularly the history department, which is very, very different in demographics, focus, ideology, culture within the Army. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to go there. So I got to kind of re-dip myself into the civilian world, got to meet some really phenomenal faculty and students. I got to get a sense, as a guy a little bit older in the profession, got to get a sense, a real good sense of the generation up and coming that is joining the military now, both as enlisted and junior officers. The men and women who are coming into that age group now and starting to join the military and going to do things like master's programs and PhD programs are very different than my generation. So the opportunity to see what is important to them, to see how they think, to see, what they want out of the world and the humans around them was invaluable, I think, to bringing back to the Army and understanding where our military is going in order to match the civilian populace that we are clients for. And then obviously the PhD education itself was great. Just the classes were phenomenal. And my ability to focus on one topic for 3 years and work really diligently on it, working on the expansion of the military for World War One, was just as somebody who's interested in education and research and increasing my own knowledge was invaluable. So highly recommended. Anybody wants to talk about the program itself, the ADSO it incurs, what jobs you might have afterwards, as well as how to position yourself to be most competitive. Always happy to talk about it.
Sir, thanks for that really good oversight. I think if I hadn't already V-tipped to FA-59, I'd be looking to drop my packet. And for anybody in Colonel Finney's circle of mentors and mentorees, you can't see it on the podcast, but he did show up wearing a Duke hat and repping his school colors. So, sir, thank you so much for your time. This has been a absolutely fascinating discussion on the whole spectrum of human dimension, ethics, professionalism, and our joint and army efforts in Indo-PACOM. Do you have any closing words for the audience, such as any future projects or where our listeners can find some of your best writing?
Yeah, thanks. So first of all, thanks for the opportunity. This was a really fun discussion. I'm really happy to know that you guys have started this podcast. I hope when you guys move on and you hand it over to others, they keep it going. I think it's a great forum. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the topics that we did. For anybody, you know, that wants to find me, you can pretty much find me on any social media outlet. You probably just Google my name and you'll come across some of my writings. If anybody has any questions about anything I know or, you know, FA-59, ASP-3, Indo-Pacific, experiences on the Army staff, don't hesitate to reach out. I'm always happy to talk to folks, put you into contact with others who are much smarter and more experienced than me in whatever you're looking for. That's one thing that I learned from folks like Jim Greer and Francis Park here in the 59 is it's all about the networks and helping each other out. And I'm willing to pay that forward as well. So do not hesitate to reach out. And thank you again for letting me come chat with you guys.
This has been an official publication of the School of Advanced Military Studies. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS and the Operational Arch by following us on Twitter at @US_SAMS. Please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have any recommendations for an episode, send any proposals to operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.